This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
We're talking today with Walter Boyd by phone in Chicago, who is director of the Faith and Criminal Justice Division of the Protestants for the Common Good. Welcome, Walter.
Oh, glad to be with you.
Appreciate your taking time on this Sunday night to talk with us about issues of criminal justice and the criminal justice initiative that you're part of. Tell us, what is this initiative?
Well, you know, Protestants for the Common Good, the organization for which I work, you know, we act for social justice and common good as essential to the Christian faith. And we spend much of our time educating, mobilizing people of faith to be effective participants in our political democracy. And my particular interest is in the criminal justice area because we have so many people who just seem to be floundering in our society, no longer actively engaged in criminal activity, but just suffering from the many barriers that have been created by a conviction. It may have been a low-level nonviolent drug offense, but those offenses stay on people's records for not just 5 years or 10 years, but 100 years. And as a result, individuals can't find work. They're discriminated against in employment, housing, education. And it's just, you know, not helping anyone. Certainly not them and their families. Certainly not society at large, because it puts us at greater risk of public safety.
And you talk about there being very many of these people who have difficulty being rehabilitated after having served their time for these offenses and so forth. How many, for example, in the state of Illinois, and I know that's probably comparable to what our listeners in Indiana would experience as well.
Well, it's estimated that we have 500,000 people with criminal records in the state of Illinois. And we have about maybe in the country at large, we arrest 600,000 every year.
So there are that many going into the jails and prisons. And I noticed from the statement on the Protestants for the Common Good website about the Faith and Criminal Justice Initiative that the object is to reform the injustices that are in the system, whether it's in terms of the way police deal with folks or the judicial process or the penal system, and to work for resources and services that do help with the actual rehabilitation of prisoners in jails and prisons and removing these legal and employment barriers that there are so many of, as you say, for ex-offenders.
Yes, in Illinois, We have about 47,000 people currently in the Department of Corrections, and we release about 39,000 each year. About half of those individuals will be recidivists in the next 3 years. Matter of fact, 3 years is the measuring stick that's used to determine recidivism. And most of that recidivism is due to a great extent to the inability of people to find gainful employment or to enroll in educational or training programs, or having the means by which to stabilize their lives in stable housing. And so we work to remedy, to whatever extent we can, those barriers that people are facing, because, I mean, it just doesn't seem fair. When you think and consider that 70% of the prison population. I think when most people think about the prison population, they think about, you know, almost cartoonish figures of, you know, real, almost, you know, Hollywood type of figures with scars and all these things on their bodies, and they're just hard individuals. But the truth of the matter is that 70% of our prison population are people who are there for drug offenses.
70%?
70%. Of course, that number also includes people who are there for possession, some for sales. But I have found in my studies that, you know, we rail really hard against the people who are involved in manufacturing and delivering, which is sales. But I found that most of those people, particularly on the street level, are individuals that are involved in drug use themselves.
Uh-huh.
And find that the means by which they can support their drug habit is to make it available to the others, you know, or they might go out and sell a little enough to meet their needs of their own drug dependency. And they by no means are they or can they be considered to be drug traffickers or kingpins. But they're rarely arrested and rarely convicted when they are. So we're literally become a prison nation, and it's been on the back of a lot of poor folk because that's where drugs seem to impact the deepest.
Because people who have a certain amount of money can hire perhaps better attorneys who can find ways to keep them from being in prison.
Well, that's a point that's been made. We know also that there is some disproportionality just in their arrest records. We know from a number of different research sources that drug use, for instance, is pretty much the same across all races. There's good research out of a number of different research groups that has demonstrated about a 9% drug use rate across whether it be white, black, or Hispanic populations. Yet, African-American men are 8 times more likely to be arrested and for a drug offense than a white male, and maybe 4 times more likely to be arrested than an Hispanic male. So there's this disproportionality is a big problem because it's underlying injustice in this. And we know when we incarcerate people for these low-level nonviolent drug offenses, we aren't helping them and we aren't helping ourselves in creating enhanced public safety because these are offenses that people do not go to jail for long periods of time, 6 months to a year at the most, and there's not enough time for them to be for a drug treatment to be implemented or administered within that period of time. And so they're back out on the street again with no help, no resources, and a conviction, which means even if they already had gotten their head right, now they can't get a job. They can't.
It's hard to even find an apartment.
Sure. People are doing background checks.
Of course.
For apartments these days and even to get loans or, you know, to even enroll in school.
Uh-huh.
You know, if you have matter of fact, you can't get a Pell Grant or a student loan if you have a drug offense. And it just seems to be counterintuitive what we're doing because it seems like we're making a permanent underclass out of a group of people who have, for whatever reason, got themselves caught up in drug addiction. And we have began to realize through much research that this is really a public health issue and not a criminal justice issue. We had an opportunity maybe 38, 40 years ago. We could have taken these drug issues and we could have put them under the health care agencies in the country. But instead, we went the criminal justice route. And as a result, drugs are cheaper and more available today than they were then. And our prison population has increased by 500%.
Amazing.
So, I mean, what we have done, I think at the time when the war on drugs was first began by President Nixon, it was well-intended. But I think once we realize that it's not getting the desired result, it's time to change policies.
Let me give a phone number for listeners who might like to join this conversation. We're always eager to have other voices join our guests. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for this program, and I'm happy to ask questions, but also happy to have others. If you'd like to do that in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. If you're listening and it's a long-distance call, please use our toll-free number. That's 1-800-222-9455. Walter, can you still hear me?
Yes, I can.
Great. Heard some clicks, and I wasn't sure what that sound was.
I think it was another call trying to come in. Of course, I didn't click over.
I see. All right, fine. Thank you. All right. We're talking with Walter Boyd, who is the director of the Faith and Criminal Justice Initiative for Protestants for the Common Good. We're talking to him from Chicago by phone. Walter, you were just saying that we've really become kind of a prison nation, and you've talked about the huge increase in the number of people who are in prison, many of them, as you say, for low-level, nonviolent drug offenses. Just last week it happened, we replayed a program here on Keeping the Faith with a social worker who had experience with a homeless, mentally ill man who was recently imprisoned for 3 years. He had found a cell phone, and when he called the person whose number was on it, and he said he'd like $50 to get it back, and so he'd had some other minor offenses before on his record, and so they considered that to be a crime to try to get money for returning a cell phone, and though he didn't really threaten the person or anything, but nevertheless he's mentally ill. He's in prison, and apparently, I heard statistics recently that in the last 40 years, the number of people in mental institutions has, dropped by 90% or so, but the number of people in prison who are mentally ill has increased by a similar amount. Is that your experience?
Well, if you remember, here in Illinois, during the 80s, we closed down a number of mental health facilities, which left a vacuum in terms of what to do with mental health patients. Sometimes mental health patients act out in a way that can be identified as criminal behavior. But when you take into consideration the mental health disability that they suffer from, it could be an affirmative defense if it had been used effectively. But we have turned our prisons also into a warehousing of our mentally ill, as well as those people who have been involved in criminal activity. There are many people in the Illinois Department of Corrections who are there probably due to mental illness as the base diagnosis for their condition.
Tell us about some of the programs that you're involved with trying to help people who are ex-offenders.
Well, one of the things that we are currently doing is trying to enhance opportunities to create diversion, which would be community-based treatment and programming, as opposed to sending people to prison. When we send someone to prison, we have to stop and consider the collateral damage, not just to the individual, but to the families. Oftentimes, these are women, sometimes more often men, but always family members, and many times parents. And when we send someone to prison for a low-level nonviolent offense, we have not protected ourselves. We have only sent someone to prison for doing something that we don't like, as opposed to someone who we're afraid of. I'm of the opinion that prisons were built for people who we're afraid of. And we are concerned about being in the general public. But these are individuals who have shown greater harm to themselves than they have other individuals. Uh-huh. And by taking them out of the community, we really cut off their networks of support. We disconnect them from their children, which causes problems in the children. Children of ex-offenders are six times more likely than other children to become ex-offenders themselves. So I have to believe that there is a relationship between the loss of the parent to the prison that is having an effect on that child in its development, as well as the cost to society. That child may end up on the welfare or on the Department of Children and Family Services call, or there may be other problems that exist in the family that result from the loss of a family member to prison, as well as estrangement, which when people come home, they need a solid foundation. Many people just can't make it when they come back out of prison simply because they don't have a solid foundation, because so many of the tentacles of family have been broken. And there's no real place for them to lay their head, so to speak. They might get to sleep on the couch of a sister, you know, but as time goes on and they can't get a job, can't get employment, and can't contribute to the family, their welcome wears thin real quick. And so we need to think about what we do and the consequences for incarceration when we send people to prison.
What are some of the options of other than prison for people like this?
Well, we know that when we send someone to prison, it on average costs us as taxpayers $21,000 a year. We can provide a person with comprehensive treatment for a fraction of that amount. And also we can keep a better tab on how they're doing in their progress. You know, one of the things that we could do is do adequate and assessments of individuals to determine what their needs are. In a lot of cases, once those needs are met, people can move their lives forward and become productive citizens. But we're not doing that. What we're doing is just responding with the criminal justice. That's our take. We just, you know, we prosecute, we arrest and prosecute. And I just think that, you know, given what we know about addiction, and I know that I'm speaking a lot about addiction because this is one of the things that, you know, it's really very difficult to, when you really know the facts. And
70%, you said, of the people in prison were there because of drug offense.
Yeah, I mean, right. You know, that's the starting point. That's where we have to start and take a look.
Walter, we have a caller waiting on line one who has a question or comment. Yes, you're on the air with our guest, Walter Boyd.
Okay, hello. Going back about 30 years, I recall doing a bit of work with Larry Johnson, the local attorney, who in his office had a, I believe, state-run facility for placing released prisoners on regular or opening-type work projects. I hope there's something like that still in order. But in the line of talking about prison work, we seem to have a tremendous private prison industry in the community, two or three places in town or more, where people are ankle braceleted and compelled to work 12-hour shifts without much benefit. And then speaking of prison industry, what's the connection with the privately owned and operated prison systems? I've given a lot to talk about. I'd like to listen to it.
That is a trend. Privatization is taking place all across our economy, and prisons are an area where people have seen an opportunity. But it's not a sustainable way of dealing with criminal justice, and it creates the wrong incentives. Now you're incentivizing incarceration in order to enhance profit. And I just think that that is not the purpose of the Department of Corrections. I just think that that becomes immoral at a certain point. People become a cash crop that is bought and sold before the bench. And I think it skews our motives in terms of what we should be trying to do to correct the ills of our society. And some people look at it as an opportunity, and others see it as a tremendous injustice, and I happen to be one to see it as a terrible injustice. In terms of Illinois, we haven't privatized the Department of Correction quite yet. We have privatized aspects of the department, like the health care and other aspects. But in other states, they do have private prisons. And those have become the greatest lobby for enhanced penalties. They are trying to protect their interests. Whenever we find a way to create more diversion to keep people from going to prison and keep them in the communities and with their families, or we create reentry opportunities where people can be assessed and attain some training and get some job skills that allow them to matriculate into the mainstream, they seek to undermine those policies with policies that enhance penalties in other areas to protect their financial interests. And it just doesn't seem that that's what America should be about. I'd never have thought of America as that kind of country, and I won't. I just don't accept that. But I do know there are individuals who are driven by the profit motive, but this is profit on the back of human beings. You know, this isn't a cash crop that should be considered for economic gain.
With the increase in the number of people in prison over the last 30, 40, 50 years, there's also been a huge growth in the industry of people who design and build prisons, including architects and builders and specialists in all these things. Electronic monitoring, all of those are sort of part of the modern prison industry.
Yeah.
That comes as a result of the huge amount of people that are in prison. And, of course, in our country where we have so many people happy to be carrying guns with them for their own personal protection, supposedly, Illinois, I guess, is the last state that still says you cannot carry a concealed weapon as an individual. Typically.
Well, we had a bill in the General Assembly.
I know. With a lot of pressure to pass.
Exactly.
But, you know, our country has so many more prisoners than other Western industrialized countries, and we have, of course, so many more guns. It's an amazing thing that we can't find other ways. You talked about diversion as one of the things you do to help try to solve this problem. What are some of the other programs of Protestants for the Common Good?
Well, we are part of Adult Redeploy, Illinois Adult Redeploy. I'm on the oversight board, and we are trying to use a formula that is called Justice Reinvestment, which takes money from the Department of Corrections to fund community-based program and to derive from that a cost avoidance to the Department of Corrections by keeping people in the community. We know that we can provide services and also provide intense supervision, particularly when you're talking about these low-level nonviolent drug offenders, to people for in the community on programs like enhanced probation or enhanced parole. These are people who would have been prison-bound had they, upon conviction, but are diverted to programs that allow them to stay in the community and stay in their families. And we can derive a great cost avoidance to the Department of Corrections, which in turn is a benefit to the taxpayers of the state of Illinois. We are spending over $1.4 billion to maintain our Criminal Justice Department of Corrections. And we should be able to reduce that to maybe half of what it is if we really were aggressive in our opportunities to create diversion opportunities. Things like probation violator caseloads or to create mental health courts that would allow people to be properly assessed so that they could get the treatment that they need, or intensive probation supervision. That would allow us to monitor the behavior of individuals who are drug addicted, who are going through treatment programs in such a way as to enhance their ability to succeed. That should be our goal, to enhance people's ability to succeed by doing an adequate assessment of what deficits they have. If it's job training, then we can offer job training at a fraction of what we pay just to house someone in the Department of Corrections. Now think about it. This person is being housed at the cost of $21,000 a year and not receiving any benefits from that. And when they come back into society, they're no better off. They're no better to move their lives forward. Matter of fact, they have suffered a huge blow, particularly if this is the first offense. Now this is a person who has to answer yes to that question. It's on the job application, have you ever been convicted of a felony? And that is the kiss of death to many people seeking employment. And employers are not getting it, you know, because they don't seem to use any rational relationship between the type of offense and the type of work that they're asking people to do. Sometimes there's no reason to deny a person a job because they, in the past, they had a drug offense, given the nature of the work that you're asking them to do. Now, if you ask them to work in a pharmacy, that might raise a question mark. But if you're asking them to or do some other type of work that would not in any way be a temptation for them, then that shouldn't be a consideration. And most of those folks, once they get into a treatment program and understand their addiction, they can move their lives forward quite well. Treatment has been proven to be a successful means of addressing drug addiction. But most poor folk and the largest majority of people who are in prison for drug offenses are the poor. But not to distinguish them in any way, because, you know, people of all economic groups and all racial backgrounds are using drugs almost in equal proportion. But the people who end up in the prison setting are the ones who can't afford, as you said earlier in the program, the adequate representation, and they are sort of put in a position where it's easier for them to take a plea bargain than to seek other means of addressing their needs.
Let me give our phone numbers again for listeners who'd like to make a contribution to our conversation or ask a question. In Champaign-Urbana area, in the 217 area code, please punch in 333-9455. If it's a long-distance call, and perhaps you're even listening online to our podcast, you can use our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We're about halfway through our program, talking today with Walter Boyd, who is the director of the Faith and Criminal Justice Initiative of the Protestants for the Common Good organization here in the state of Illinois. We're talking about criminal justice and ways people can be rehabilitated after serving time or perhaps kept out of prisons to start with. We'll be getting back to that discussion in just a minute. Let me tell listeners what's coming up on Keeping the Faith in the next few weeks. Next week, we'll be talking with Professor Roger Geiger, that's G-E-I-G-E-R, from Penn State University, about changes in American higher education over the last 30 years. That's on July 17. On July 24, our guests will be two folks who for the last year have filled in as directors of the Hillel Foundation for Jewish Students here at the University of Illinois, Rafe Melhado and Jessica Kavanaugh Melhado. So they'll be talking about their year here at the Hillel Foundation for Jewish Students. Claudia Lenhoff will be our guest on the 31st of July, along with Mr. M.D. Pelmore from the Hill Street neighborhood. And we're going to be talking about some of the pollution issues with the finding of a pipe that was draining into one of the creeks here in this neighborhood. And the Champaign County Healthcare Consumers Organization that Claudia Lenhoff is director of has been working with that group trying to solve that problem. We'll be hearing about that on the 31st. First week in August, Rabbi Alyssa Wise will be our guest. She is the works with the Jewish Voice for Peace. We'll be talking with her by phone from California. Those are some of the programs coming up on Keeping the Faith. I'm Steve Shoemaker, your usual host, although Don Nolan fills in quite capably on times when I can't be in this studio. Don is a retired professor of philosophy and religion at Parkland College. Well, getting back to Walter Boyd and our talking about the Criminal Justice Initiative, Walter, you were talking about ways to keep people out of prison. I know that Protestants for the Common Good also does some education and advocacy work on the whole issue of decriminalizing the use of marijuana in the state of Illinois. There are other states that have done this, of course, and things like the medical marijuana being dispensed legally in other states, all things considered, that we just followed, had a little blip on that in Denver. But this is rather controversial for a religious organization to be involved with, isn't it?
Well, it would seem so, but when you stop and consider the evidence, particularly from the science community, from researchers all across the country, I mean, there has been an overwhelming, not just anecdotal evidence, but, I mean, we have a bill called House Bill 30, which seeks to make medical marijuana or medical cannabis, or it's called the Compassionate Use Act, available to people with some of the most debilitating diseases. And it seems incredible that there's resistance against it. These are people who are suffering from diseases such as cancer, Crohn's disease, hepatitis C, immune deficiency diseases such as HIV, wasting syndrome, seizures, glaucoma, and a number of other of what we call debilitating illnesses that otherwise would be relegated to taking some of the harshest chemicals that we have in our formulary. I mean, these are people who are taking OxyContin and fentanyl, and the drugs are having a harsher effect and more side effects than they claim they receive when they use marijuana. Now, the unfortunate thing is these people are accessing marijuana to treat their condition. But as a result of our laws, this makes them criminal. Even when there's a bona fide doctor-patient relationship, there are doctors who have come forward and recognized that marijuana has been beneficial to their patients in easing their discomfort and their pain, particularly in the case of wasting syndrome and people who are under chemotherapy, where there's a lot of nausea and stomach-related ailments. This has put weight back on people who have wasted to a half of who they previously were. And it's still a debate as to whether or not they should be allowed in the context of a doctor-patient relationship to access medical marijuana. Now, it doesn't necessarily have to be smoking. It can be eaten. It can be used as a tincture. It can be made into an oil. There's one woman who I've walked the halls of the General Assembly with many times, and on many occasions I've seen her had to leave early because of illness. But she had a tumor that was growing, and it was inoperable, and it was growing in her head. And with the use of marijuana oil, she had gained her sight back from blindness as a result of the growth of that tumor. And the doctors really said that as a result of marijuana being a Schedule I drug, which means it has no, but according to the federal government, Schedule I means a drug that has no medicinal benefit and no benefit to society. Well, we know that's not true. But we know that, you know, marijuana is also categorized as Schedule I because it's a drug that we target as part of the international drug trafficking interdiction that we want to engage in. So we have targeted marijuana along with cocaine, heroin, which I believe are very dangerous drugs. But in the case of the marijuana, this has proven itself to have many medicinal benefits. There are like 66 cannabinoids that are found in marijuana. And we even have organizations like the Cannabinoid Society, which just held a conference in St. Charles, Illinois, just last week. And they are sponsored by pharmaceutical groups, talking about the benefits of the cannabinoids in marijuana. And I don't see a problem of a doctor prescribing marijuana to a patient any more than I see a problem in a doctor prescribing fentanyl or Oxycontin or any of these debilitating drugs that we know are going to shut down their livers, their kidneys, and do damage to their body while trying to fight off a debilitating illness. And marijuana has none of these side effects. The patients will attest. I mean, you know, it's something to hear the testimony of individuals who have been brought back from almost the brink of death as a result of being exposed to marijuana, and to hear them come forward and give their testimony under the threat of bringing criminal attention to themselves. I mean, these are people who have to come forward and say, look, I'm using marijuana to work with, deal with my illness. There's a man by the name of Jim Champion who is a multiple sclerosis patient, who's a war veteran, who is in Springfield with us on a regular basis. And he, you know, when he smokes marijuana, he said it just relaxes his entire body and it allows his legs to unlock from a clench that happens as a result of his multiple sclerosis. And he says that without it, he doesn't know what he would do. Someone that everyone knows and can possibly identify with is Montel Williams, the talk show host, who also has multiple sclerosis. He has been to the Illinois General Assembly with us. He is a marijuana user, and that's how he treats his multiple sclerosis. He says that he was close to suicide because he just couldn't bear the ravishes of the illness, the pain and the discomfort, until he found marijuana and the effectiveness that it had in treating his condition. We have a very prominent lawyer in one of the top firms in Chicago, which is an international law firm. He's a partner. And he's courageously come forward as a multiple sclerosis patient and said that he uses marijuana, and he's become a strong leader in this movement to try to pass this bill. We're like three votes away. We came within three votes of passing the bill during the last session, and we hope to gain those three votes over this summer going into the veto session in November, because there's really no good reason to deprive people of the medical treatments that they need in order to alleviate pain and suffering.
I know there are some communities in Urbana, Illinois, where this station is located, is one of those communities where the police have been given options because of action taken by the city council when they encounter people using marijuana, they have some options, I guess, that are at the police discretion to keep that person from being put immediately into the criminal justice system. Mm-hmm. And I know you came down and visited with some folks here in Urbana on the—
Yes.
And are there other communities in Illinois that have those kind of progressive possibilities?
Yes. Well, you know, I'm working on a research project right now. Now we're talking about a little bit of a different thing. We were previously talking about medical use.
Right.
Now we're talking about marijuana in the general public.
Right.
And it's a little bit of a different thing. But, you know, marijuana is the most popular drug next to alcohol in our society. And it, you know, is one conviction can ruin a young person's life. When you're talking about a college campus where you know there's going to be a percentage of people who are going to be interested and partake of some marijuana use. Now, most marijuana users grow out of the phase and move on to be very productive citizens. But if arrested during that period of time, this person's entire life can be derailed. And so as a result, communities across this state have begun to implement decrim where there is home rule. Those home rule jurisdictions are beginning to vote to make it just a civil penalty for small amounts. We're talking like 2.5 grams up to, or maybe some go as high as 10 grams, you know, which is what they would consider to be a personal use amount, to make it a civil penalty and raise some money on it. I mean, they might charge a fine like having alcohol in the park or in the forest preserve or something where it's not prohibited, where it's prohibited. And I think to a great extent, those communities are doing so because they want to protect the futures of their young people who they know could easily become a statistic if our marijuana laws are harsh.
We're talking with Walter Boyd, the director of the Faith and Criminal Justice Department of the Protestants for the Common Good. Phone numbers again, if you'd like to make a comment or ask a question, 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, or if it's long distance, 1-800-222-9455. And if you've missed part of this program, or if you'd like to hear other back programs from the past of Keeping the Faith, you may, at any time, at your convenience, go to our website, will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith, and you'll find the whole list there. And you can put in a word in the search box there to, if you remember a person's name or the topic, and you'll be able to find the program that you can listen to at your convenience. Someone was telling me just a week ago that they were listening via one of their smartphones through their radio in their car as they were taking a long drive, just rehearing one of our former programs. I know a lot of people do that, and that's a nice benefit that's possible through WILL. And this is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM. And if you have an HD radio, you can hear the AM program on FM 90.9 HD3. Getting back to Walter Boyd. Walter, you said there are 47,000 people in prison under the Department of Correction in the state of Illinois. And a large number of those are released each year. Of course, that means there are that many more going in each year.
Yes.
What about these people who are getting out? What kind of programs are there? What kind of rehabilitation resources are there for?
Well, for the large majority, resources, reentry resources are very scant in the state of Illinois. We have some communities that have no reentry resources. I mean, and it's more a reflection of the economy, I think. In the city of Chicago, even, we have about 39,000-40,000 people who are prison exits each year. And of that 40,000, half, more than 51% will be back in prison in the next 3 years, within the next 3 years. And that's as a result of not having opportunities for employment. We have statistics that show that when people receive supportive services, and supportive services can just be a caseworker who is helping them work through the maze of getting back into the mainstream. We can reduce the recidivism rate to 25%. When people achieve employment, it falls to 24%. When supportive services as well as employment services are offered to individuals, it falls to 13%. So we know that we can affect these numbers by engaging the population with assessment and meeting the needs that they have, filling in the gaps that make them vulnerable to repeating the mistakes of the past. People don't just enjoy prison. I don't really, I can't get into the head of everybody. There may be some people who are just nobody until they go to prison. But for the most part, it's something to avoid, and I think most people would choose to avoid being a recidivist. But when you're faced with economic barriers that don't allow you to provide for your needs, you're going to take chances. And if you're already from a poor community, just to give you some idea who's in our prison, 37% of the people who are released from our prisons and go back to communities in Chicago, and that 37% actually go back to like maybe six communities. We're talking to Austin, North Lawndale, East and West Garfield, Humboldt Park, and Inglewood. 37% of our entire prison population. Over 51% of our prison population comes from Cook County. And the 37%, the communities that they come from are experiencing negative job growth, the jobs are leaving, high unemployment rates, high poverty, median family incomes, the lowest median family incomes in the city. Many of those unemployment rates are at 35, 40%. 40% of the entire community is living in poverty. They live below the medium. I think the average household income is $22,000. That's $16,000 less than the city average. And it's kind of difficult to mount a reentry when you're going back to a community that doesn't offer you anything. When you're going back to families who are struggling day by day just to put food on the table for the kids, for the babies. And don't make the mistake of drinking the baby's milk, because then you're out the door, you know. And so it's kind of a very difficult maze that people find themselves in, engaged in the reentry process. And so we certainly encourage more of that type of engagement. But I think what we really need to do is create more diversion on the front end. It's almost cost prohibitive to take care of all of it on the back end. We need to go front end. And there's some laws that just don't seem to make sense anymore. You know, like the way we deal with marijuana, with so many communities that have home rule, even Cook County in the unincorporated areas has implemented marijuana decrim, which makes it a civil penalty. That makes it something that the county can raise money on.
Decriminalizing the offense.
Yes. And there's just no evidence that marijuana is a gateway drug. I know many people believe it, but I think that it may be a gateway drug by virtue of the fact that the same places that people go to buy marijuana, other drugs are also being sold that are also illicit.
We have a couple of callers waiting. Let's go to line number one in Rantoul. Yes, you're on the air.
Hi. I have many years of being in recovery and struggling with different things like chronic pain and post-traumatic stress disorder that got me there. There are programs, there are things like the Alexander Technique and actually Buddhist walking meditation that have proven to be really effective for helping people, especially in recovery. Is there any way to contact Mr. Boyd and perhaps talk to him about this?
Oh, most certainly. I certainly have contact information. And
is it your website address?
Yeah, our website is www.thecommongood.org.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, I'll be in touch with you then.
Well, I look forward to talking with you.
All right. Thank you very much. And this is a wonderful show. And having been to treatment myself and having a 30-year journey of working to become clean and sober, there are miracles that can happen, you know. Thank you.
Thank you for the call. And let me give that website again. It's thecommongood.org.
Yes. Yeah. www.thecommongood.org.
Thecommongood.org. And we have another caller waiting from Urbana, line number two. You're on Keeping the Faith.
Thank you. I was listening to what you were saying about treatment programs being less expensive if it could be provided in the setting of the home and the family and so on. I'm very much interested in this prisoner who was sentenced to 3.5 years in prison for what was a charge of extortion. He appeared on my front porch yesterday morning and told me that he had served the required portion of his sentence and had been released with $10.
That is absolutely the truth. $10 and a bus ticket back to the jurisdiction from which he was convicted.
Yeah.
That's about the limit of the support that an individual leaving prison gets from the state.
He was starting to make the rounds of the people who had assisted him through the years before when he was living in the garage of one person who had been a social worker. And I'm just pleased if we can find, as a community, the whole state even, get some kind of a system that is deliberately set up to give a social worker or somebody with special training equipment to assist a prisoner released like this so early. He's only been in the prison about less than a year.
Well, he has a 50-50 chance of making it for 3 years, based on the statistics.
He was continually getting into some kind of a problem. His bicycle didn't have a taillight on it, or he found this cell phone and tried to return it to the owner, and just it seemed like he was forever getting into trouble with the police.
And he's been diagnosed as being a paranoid schizophrenic, but often a person like that without help is not even able to stay on medications if they can get the medication. So it's a significant problem in our culture.
I don't know what the solution is to get that kind of help, but that's certainly, it looks like it would be a very fruitful way for us to proceed as a society.
Well, I think one of the ways to get that kind of help is for us to demonstrate through case studies that it would be cheaper to us as a society to offer some treatment in community for individuals who are at risk than it would be for us to wait until their behavior becomes so aberrant that we have to incarcerate them.
Mm-hmm.
Because then the cost to us as taxpayers is exorbitant, and we also do nothing to aid that individual in being able to work through their own issues.
I know a social worker in Chicago who works for a private agency that has her sit at her desk and her phone for 5 days a week, full 10 hours, whatever number of hours she works in a day, listening to the problems of people who are trying to make recovery from some kind of addiction. And if we could get that kind of professional help available to people who are released from prison, maybe we wouldn't even have to send them to prison in the first place.
I agree with you, sir.
Thank you for what you're doing.
Well, thank you for your call.
Appreciate the call. Others may call. We have about 6 or 7 minutes left. We could squeeze in 2 or 3 calls probably if you keep your comments relatively brief. Again, the number 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455 to speak with our guest, Walter Boyd from Protestants for the Common Good. And again, that organization's website is thecommongood.org. O-R-G. Walter, when we were talking just now with this last caller about a particular person who was mentally ill, can you give us some examples of people who have been rehabilitated, who have gotten the help they've needed, who've been able to return to be productive members of society and earning an honest living and caring for their families? Are there some good examples you can give us?
Oh, yes, absolutely. If 51% are recidivists in 3 years, that means that there are a lot of success as well. At least 48% of people are matriculating back into the mainstream in some form or fashion, or finding some stability within society that allows them to avoid being reincarcerated during that period of time. But one of the things that I think communities could look towards are crisis intervention teams. And that would be an excellent way for the police department to take the lead by obtaining some training in crisis intervention, particularly for mental health patients. Where, you know, here in the city of Chicago, they have a CIT program where if the police show up on the scene of an offense, if it's a minor offense and there are no real victims involved, but just some aberrant behavior going on, where a person would have been arrested and processed, they have a crisis team member come. This is a person who has a full bag of referral opportunities for this individual. This is a person who can refer them to to get an assessment, if it's to get follow-up medical diagnoses when that behavior warrants it, and to meet whatever needs that they have that are putting them at risk.
Walter, we have another caller. I want to try to sneak in on line number 4. Yes, you're on the air with Walter Boyd.
Hi, my name's Anne. in.
Hello,
Ann. I was a drug counselor for 2 years in a prison where we did like a therapeutic community to help, you know, get these people, get them to understand how the addiction works and actually teach them life skills.
Yes.
Because from the time that I worked there, I would say it's terrible and disappointing, but probably 20% only are the ones that wanted help. The rest of them, when they left prison, they're ready to go right back into it. And I also, there was a lot of, he was mentioning Chicago. There was a lot of the prisoners were from Chicago.
Yes.
And it seemed like it was more of like a lifestyle and life skills that they needed to know. And I mean, the drugs was contributing to that, but it was like they had never been taught how to write a resume,
exactly,
how to get a job, or anything like that.
That is exactly. You're exactly right, and that's the reason why it's so important for us to do an adequate assessment of an individual's needs. It becomes, relatively clear in a short period of time that you're dealing with people of either, you know, low educational attainment, they have limited work histories, along with substance abuse issues, as well as a felony stigmatization. So, to a great extent, many of those people have given up on successful reentry. They, to a great extent, have bought into, well, you know, I'm just going to be floundering in society, so, you know, I'm going to be the best at that, you know. But the truth is that people can turn their lives around. And given just a little bit of help and direction, you know, I've seen huge successes take place, and those individuals have gone on to become gainfully employed and supportive of their families and take their place in society.
Walter, we're going to have to stop there on that hopeful note, and I want to thank you for being on Keeping the Faith today. We've been talking with Walter Boyd. You're welcome. Good to have you here. We're talking with Walter Boyd, who's the director of the Faith and Criminal Justice Initiative projects of the Protestants for the Common Good. And again, to learn more about that organization, it's a statewide organization in Illinois. You may go to www.thecommongood.org on computer or find their phone numbers in Chicago. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs. And next week, I'll be talking with Professor Roger Geiger from Penn State University about changes in American higher education since 1980. On the 24th of July, I'll be talking with Rafe Melhado and his spouse, Jessica Cavanaugh Melhado, about their year as directors of the Hillel Foundation for Jewish students here at the University of Illinois. Claudia Lenhoff and M.D. Pelmore will be my guests on the 31st of July, talking about pollution issues in Champaign-Urbana, and the response of the Champaign County healthcare consumers. Rabbi Alyssa Wise will be our guest August 7th. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Thanks to you, Illinois Public Media, WILL, surpassed the membership goal of $2.1 million by more than $25,000. We appreciate your support. It really makes a difference.
Hi, I'm Jim Fleming, host of To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI. Looking for something to talk about at your next party or around the water cooler on Monday morning? Check in on To the Best of Our Knowledge each week. Science and religion, rethinking animal intelligence, maybe how memory works. Fascinating discussion on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday evening from 7 to 9 on AM 580. This is Illinois Public Media, W.